Support American-made, tariff-free clothing with American Giant with American Giant. They aren't affected by tariffs because their clothing products never left the U.S. Get 20% off your first order when you use promo code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com.
Ladies and gentlemen,
this is Gamer Tag Radio.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're here at Gamer Tag Radio, and joining me, we have Paris Lilly here. Paris, what's up?
Hey, how you doing?
All right, and we have a special guest. We're going to be talking about the Xbox 360 20th anniversary and, of course, other industry topics. The legend himself, Peter Moore. Peter, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Danny. How are you guys?
Everything's good. Good. I know the last time I had you on the show, it was for the 20th anniversary of the Sega Dreamcast, one of my favorite consoles of all time.
Yeah, now we just tipped 25. Yeah, it's been a while.
Time has been flying, man. So how you been? I know I see you here and there, you know, doing some speaking engagements here, but sometimes are you still in the gaming industry? Are you like here and there or you're like done completely?
No. I advise 1, 2, 3, 4 gaming developers, early startup developers and where they're heading. I think most prominently right now, Reality Games, which has got a Monopoly license for Monopoly World, which is kind of a geo-based Pokemon Go, except Monopoly, and I'm working with them. We're excited about, obviously, the Monopoly IP in games right now is huge once again, so I do that. But yeah, no, I, my number of my kids are working for EA and Future in the UK, so yeah, no, it's all, there's no escaping the industry. There's no... Yeah, no, exactly.
Now, I want to start the start of the conversation. I'm going to go way back. I know during the days that you were in Sega, when the conversation came about when you decided to make that change and go start working at Xbox in those early days.
Yeah, I mean, we were going through, obviously, with the demise of my beloved Sega Dreamcast, we were going through a difficult time as the company was, we announced on January 31st, 2001, that we would be transitioning, we, Sega, worldwide, would be transitioning to be a third party, taking our intellectual property to all platforms and no longer being a first party. It was a tough day. That's a lot of, unfortunately, let a lot of people go. But and we had this then period where we had to then kind of retransition the entire company on a worldwide basis to be that third party publisher and taking great content, Sonic, obviously, Golden Axe, Altered Beast. I mean, all of these great things, even the crazy taxis of this world, and to other platforms. And Xbox were I think, the most prominent, helping us out through a very difficult time, supporting us, putting content on the original Xbox, and really, stretching out an arm of support and saying, anything we can do to help you, because keeping Sega healthy and vibrant is good for the industry. Next thing I knew, Robbie Bach and I had formed a great relationship, but got a call to head up very quietly to Seattle to have lunch with Steve Ballmer. And Steve and I kind of hit it off over an hour and a half lunch. And, he infamously said to me, look, we don't have people like you here, meaning gamers, people who can stand on stage and talk about the industry, be the front person. Robbie was really good at that. Jay Allard, you might remember as well, but just missing some pieces in the jigsaw puzzle. And I'd kind of been going nose to nose with PlayStation for a couple of years at this point at Sega. So Robbie had recommended me, and the next thing I know, I leave Sega, and I'm on a Friday, and I'm at February 3rd, 2003. I'm at new employee orientation in Redmond, Washington, with my new blue Microsoft badge.
Nice, nice. And that was right before Xbox 360 and everything. So that was cool. And Paris, you have any questions?
So, Peter, I want to also take you back in the time machine. But before I do, I do want to also mention the Dreamcast, that it was simply ahead of its time. As far as I think about where gaming is today, and I think about gaming consoles today, a lot of those innovations started with the Dreamcast, and it'll always have a special place in my heart. But you talk about 2003, you talk about once you transition to Xbox. Another little side note, my first memory of seeing you on camera was, and God, I can't remember if it was called G4 back then or what it was, but you were with, she was Tina Wood at the time.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And Laura Foy, you're on their show and you're hyping up the Xbox and just talking about all that. And I was like, man, maybe this Xbox thing really will work. Look at this guy. He's gotten me excited about Xbox. But a question I've always wanted to ask, and since we're talking about the 20 year of Xbox 360, I was lucky enough to go to Zero Hour, which was the launch of the 360, and actually got to meet you and Jay Allard. I still have a picture with both of you at that event. But the question I've always wanted to ask, who came up with that idea? Because in my mind, it's the greatest gaming event ever. So who had that idea and what was the origin of it?
The origin of it was we probably the summer of that year, so 5 months before launch, where I can see it now, sat in a conference room in the Millennium campus that was outside. We the Xbox team were not in what's known as the Borg. We were not on part of the Microsoft campus. We were kind of little rebellious. We had our own little campus, and in Millennium B, conference room 1216, I can see it now, talking to the team, which is as we're thinking about launch and we're starting to think about the concept of how do we make sure we put our gamer front and center rather than do the traditional, you know, which quite frankly I did at Sega, you know, on the VMAs and really focused on the retailer. All of our efforts prior to that was on the retailer. So how do we turn our efforts towards the gamer and make something special and cool, innovative that hadn't been done before? A little risky for a lot of reasons, but and we came up with this concept then of why don't we go find somewhere in the middle of nowhere, in this particular instance, Palmdale, California, and give it this kind of Area 51 vibe of mystery and what's going on here. But it was very much the concept of gamer first. And, you know, our mantra was the Xbox 360 was a living entertainment experience powered by human energy. That was the line everybody knew. And the human energy was the gamer. It wasn't Best Buy, Walmart, Target. It was the game. Right. And so we felt we could do something different and innovative and put the gamer front and center. And Zero Hour, for those who don't know, was literally in the middle of nowhere in the Central Valley of California. There you go. There you go.
Zero Hour.
Yeah. And it was the night of launch. And as you know, we found these massive airplane hangars and decked it all out, this fluorescent green vibe. It was very much Twilight Zone-ish. And hundreds of beanbags, hundreds of demo.
Yes, the beanbags. Yes, I remember.
At launch. And we pulled it together in just a few months. A lot of people had to work really hard to get it done. It hadn't been done before. Dealing with gamers, all kinds of liability issues. I'll tell you a little story that I may have told, may not have told, but first guy in line, somebody comes to me and says, he's carrying a gun. And wait.
Oh, what? My God. What?
And, you know, we had security there. And if you recall Paris, there was like the parking lot. People had come in RVs. And the idea was how far away can we make this place and difficult to get to that gamers will go the extra mile to do it? But, yeah, I always remember somebody coming to me. And there was a line to get in. And everybody got there in the afternoon, ready for midnight and what have you. And, yeah, guy says, got a gun. And it was fine. You know, he had a carry license or whatever, but we asked him nicely, don't bring the gun in.
And, I can imagine.
Stuff that we hadn't thought about, you know, it came together so quickly. And but I remember everybody having a great time. Jay and I said a few words, and then, of course, the hangar doors opened, and you can still see the photographs online of this green glow. And there were...
I have them. Yep.
Yep. Hundreds.
Yeah, it was amazing seeing the pictures and videos on that. Yeah. It was really cool.
You know, it was this first movement to move away a little bit from the retailer being our primary focus and the gamer being our focus. And, you know, that accelerated as we moved digitally into this world of where no longer was the retailer your customer, you guys were our customer. And certainly at EA, we accelerated that movement as well. But this was very much about gamer first, putting the gamer first.
Yeah, I know during those days, and look, the 360 era, there were so many exclusives, so many special moments, you know, experience that as a fan. What was like your favorite either 360 exclusive moment where like either an announcement or a partnership with a third party? Because I would love to hear your thoughts on that from back in those days.
You know, the two that jumped to mind are kind of back-to-back E3s, the announcement of Halo and everything.
The tattoo.
And then the following year, you know, it was Grand Theft Auto and getting that franchise on the platform.
Yeah, it was
again,
a big deal.
For those who don't know, it was a PlayStation exclusive for many years. And you could see how that franchise in particular, and look at it now, you know, was starting to drive a more mature consumer. It was starting to take full advantage of obviously the graphical power of the high definition of Xbox 360. And I think it was the stickiness of GTA. It said to gamers, we see you as mature adults. This is no longer content that you will pass through in a phase and get onto more mature things. GTA, as controversial as it obviously was at times, you know, if anybody remembers Hot Chocolate, you know, I think it signified a maturing of the industry, no pun intended, you know, put us on par with movies and music and you know, kind of during that period or a little bit before that period, we were fighting for respect. We were the root of all evil in society, we being gaming. And, you know, I spoke in Senate hearings in Washington, D.C. on behalf of the gaming industry to, you know, make sure people understood this isn't some, you know, polluting of young boys' minds. This is a legitimate entertainment medium that is interactive in nature and was about to be taking full advantage of the internet in ways even movies and music weren't. And that was that moment in time during that period.
So question I have, and you've talked about this in the past as far as making the decision to up the memory in the Xbox 360 at the time, obviously the Red Ring of Death that has been highlighted many times over the years. But something, again, I've always been curious about is the decision to end the original Xbox generation early and launch 360 essentially a year early in 2005. What went into that decision? Was it just the competition of trying to get ahead of Sony?
It was a combination of another issues. Look, we were losing money right, left, and center on the original Xbox. When your install base and your attach rate to the install base are so out of sync, we knew where we were going with high definition, with broadband in particular, and the legacy platform, the original Xbox, wasn't going to deliver that. And there's an inflection point. There's a law of diminishing returns in video games that if you haven't sold in enough units, and even worse, if your attach rate of software to hardware is below where you were projected, you're just hemorrhaging cash. And we were. I mean, the good news is we were Microsoft, so we could afford to hemorrhage cash, taking the long view of where we wanted to go in the industry. But at the same time, it just made no sense. We weren't bringing in gamers that we wanted. And we were very fixated on broadband being the future and very much delivering a high-definition experience, one of the, you know, the first high-def console that, you know, 720p, 1080i, I think at that point, 7.1 sound. Perhaps most importantly, delivering Xbox Live. Which the original Xbox wasn't going to be able to do for us. So it was probably a unique situation. So we're going to go out of business for a little while. And, you know, we're still going to support you to have Xbox. But typically, as you know, it's like there's a seamless transition, hopefully, from one console to another that companies do. We just said, we're not making any of these anymore. Plenty of notice to the gamer. And we wanted to also... The relationships that our very talented third-party team there in Redmond have built with all of the publishers, both Western and Japanese, was very much we wanted them focused on Xbox 360. Xenon, as it was at that time, but Xbox 360. And so you wanted your game publisher development partners to, here's our dev kits, here's the early dev kits, and forget about this thing and focus on this thing. And you know, as history tells us, it worked out very well.
Speaking about Japanese, man, how was it for you in those days getting those opportunities working with new partners in Japan? Because they were always focused on working with PlayStation. Was it really difficult to get them to support Xbox in those days, Xbox 360?
Yeah. I mean, look, the numbers walk in the end. Yeah, I mean, look, I've been over there for 4 years, 5 years prior at Sega, obviously, and was very... very aware of the Japanese market and the roots and the incredible loyalty the Japanese gamer shows to his or her gaming companies, both publishers and hardware. It was never going to be easy, but we spent a lot of time going over, sitting down with the Namcos, the Capcoms, the Konamis of this world, and laying out a vision for what we would be. Particularly the world of the internet and high-speed broadband, and then laying out a longer-term vision of, you know, bigger hard drives and having more content and having this vision of a different business model that was less about, here's your getting whatever it is, 50,000 yen for the game and, move on to the next year. No, let's figure out how we can engage the gamer through online, through services like Xbox Live, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And to the credit of many of these companies, they bought into that. And not to say that they walked away from PlayStation, obviously that wasn't the case at all. But they saw Microsoft coming in as healthy for the industry. Now you've got two financial juggernauts in Sony and Microsoft going at it. In the old days, obviously, it was Sega and Nintendo. Now, you know, Nintendo's still there and, boy, flourishing every day, obviously, today. But having technology companies come in and who grasp the opportunity of the future, grasp and understand memory, broadband speeds, and build out software. I mean, PlayStation struggled at first, and that allowed us, I think, a good 12 months to 18 months lead with Xbox Live. We took full advantage of that lead and built out this kind of network effect of all of a sudden, if you're in the schoolyard and you didn't have an Xbox and weren't playing Halo 2, you were out of it a little bit. And so that allowed us. It allowed us that head start. Obviously, the pricing advantage we had as well. And we were just hell-bent on my mantra was first to 10 million units wins. And I always remember saying that and was quoted on that. But I felt that you get that tailwind behind you, the network effect of great content, the third parties coming over to your side even more. And that's what happened. I mean, look, it was a great period because both the PlayStation 3 and the Xbox 360 flourished. And when you look back now and the numbers were immense, you know, and I think somewhere in the region of 120 million units each, sold through, which is phenomenal for the industry. And I think that the impact of that period still exists today of bringing all of those gamers in this somewhat of a golden period for gaming.
Yeah, I remember the reason why I asked that question is because I remember there was a lot of like RPG games from Japan. I remember... some of them first party, some of them not. Lost Odyssey, Blue Dragon. I remember being at E3 when you guys made the announcement of having Final Fantasy for the first time into the platform. I go like, oh, this is looking good, you know. So, yeah.
Yeah, look, go for Panzer Dragoon, if you remember that, and you know you've got
classic.
What you look at, you're looking at your gamers, and you're going, all right, we've got the shooter, if you will, with Halo. But you didn't want to be, and we always were not paranoid, but we were always conscious, you didn't want to be the shooter box. So the way it was working is you need to grab that action-adventure fan. You need to go get that, maybe that with JRPG, Japanese role-playing games. You know, is there an MMO that you need? And all of this what we tried to do in particular with the launch portfolio for Xbox 360 is bring as many of those different cohorts and genres in to say, this is my box, you know, particularly move them away from PlayStation.
No, absolutely. And you kind of started talking about just kind of where the industry is now. And I do want to touch on that. But I find it interesting that you left in 2007 because it doesn't seem like you did. It seems like you were there longer than 2007. But essentially, you left Xbox, in my personal opinion, in its greatest year ever. You left it in good hands because I think 2007.
Other than the Red Halo Rings 3, of Death,
BioShock.
Yes.
Yeah. Matt, well, yeah. you'd recovered from that at that point, yeah. Right? No, you know, you obviously made the decisions that you needed to make to recover from that. But 2007 was and again, my opinion, probably the greatest year for Xbox. The reason I bring that up is I want to fast forward to where we are now today, because back then, obviously, exclusive games and some of the third party deals that were being made, like with Grand Theft Auto, were essential to get people to buy the box. So that was the box for them. Like, I remember when Call of Duty, when Modern Warfare came out back then, I just thought of it as being only on Xbox, even though it was on other devices at the time. Obviously, Halo 3 was a big deal that year as well. But I want to talk about now and what Xbox is doing right now, because it is clearly controversial. It is somewhat disruptive to what they're doing. So I'm just curious of your perspective of this multi-platform strategy for Xbox, but still wanting to make hardware at the same time. What's your perspective on that?
Look, the industry has evolved, has matured. I like to think we weren't quite the pioneers, but certainly, you know, we, I think, gave the industry credibility. We thumped our chest at what was the IDSA in the old days, the ESA, E3, in the early years, the early 2000s, was a phenomenal platform for us to get off the back pages and to get on the front pages and to be taken seriously as an entertainment medium. With cynical press, who again, blamed all of society's ills on video games, waste of time, creating violence, blah, 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 all of that. And we needed to do a ton of missionary work in those days. And at the same time, you know, we were young enough to have fun and do all the daft stuff that we did and all the stunts. And I think that, you know, the console wars that you're kind of alluding to were healthy for the industry. And look, I've said it before, we just, certainly I did, encouraged the battle because I think gamers loved to see Xbox versus PlayStation, maybe Nintendo as well. You know, and that I think was a rising tide that lifted all ships there. It's different today. And when you see that, you know, look what's happened with the acquisitions or the consolidation, and what Microsoft, you know, and I still say, if they had the choice, would they make hardware? No. Would they be delighted if they could be a multi-$100 billion entity delivering, you know, content directly to your television, to whatever monitor you choose to play on? You bet. And you know, in the classically Netflix model, if you will, you just select who's playing this. Right. 5,000 people playing this. I'm going to jump in right now. No latency, no lag. You're in. And there doesn't need to be a box between you and your controller and the TV set. But still, you know, consoles are, as we're seeing, particularly with Nintendo now, people love their hardware. The acquisition of Activision Blizzard changed things, I think, I know, at Microsoft. And so this is not the old days of the console wars and punching each other and trying to steal customers and trying to get market share and build your attach rate.
Right.
This is bigger than that in an economic sense. Has it lost a little bit of the feistiness that the industry, I think, fed upon and grew upon? I think so. Yeah. I mean, and look, I've been gone from the industry 8 years. You know, I left EA to go to Liverpool in 2017. So it's been a long time. Do I yearn for the old days? Do I look back fondly to when things crop up in my social media feed of this was you 15 years ago and you see great photos of things in E3? Yeah. But I think we as an industry then positioned the industry for where it is now. It's different. And yeah, what Microsoft is doing is no longer we're going to get as much content on our singular platform and the PC, and we're going to fight for that, and we're going to pay for that, and we're not going to give it to anybody else. And you know, those days are clearly over, as you can see.
Yeah, you know what you remind me right now is, I know you mentioned PC, but it reminds me of Games for Windows Party at E3 2007. Paris was there. It reminded me, you guys were really pushing the Xbox, you know, PC and all that at that time. What do you think of Xbox and PC gaming now today, in your opinion, compared to like those days back then?
It was just, like I say, it's different. It's, you know, when, if you'd have told me then that Microsoft's the biggest financial acquisition of all time would be a gaming company, I'd have laughed. Mm-hmm. I mean, we struggled even internally during that period with people, parts of the company that thought this was a waste of time. This was very much, you know, the kind of Windows into Internet Explorer period. And Microsoft was not an entertainment company, and it was our job to get it in the living room. You know, in simple terms, the concern was, again, it you look at it now and you kind of scratch your head, that Sony was going to own the living room. You know, they had music, they had cameras, they had televisions, you know, the Trinitron. I mean, you think about it. Now, today it's different. And competition from all over the world, in Sony's case, Samsung and LG pounding on them at one end, Microsoft coming at them on the other end, you know, kind of a pincer movement that squeezed them. But we Microsoft, were worried that we would be forever relegated to the office or maybe your laptop on your desk, but would never, ever have a ticket to the living room. And, you know, that's where, and Bill was always, you know, pounding on the desk of this, was we need to get into that living room. And it was very clear once high def was coming in, and the graphical quality of what we were delivering at that time, blowing people away. When I think of Gears of War and Cameo and, you know, again, 15, 18 years ago, whatever we are, 18 years ago, it's just, these were things. And just an example, you know, Best Buy were calling for our demo units into the TV section because the Xbox 360 was the only device at that moment that was delivering high definition content. So they were showing off their high def TVs with games like Cameo. You know, Gears of War would have been a little rough in the TV section, but mm-hmm. Yeah, Cameo certainly fit that bill. So yeah, I mean, look, it's a different industry. The stakes are higher, and technology continues, that ever flowing river of technology continues to flow, and it's a different time and a different place. So different business models have evolved, and yeah, if you'd have told me that you know, stuff that would be owned by a first party would show up on other platforms, that would be contrary to the fight that we were, you know, battling at that time.
You know what? I just remember now going to E3 05, and this is first time I got to see you. You were walking with Steven Spielberg. You were showing him Condemned and a couple other games there at the booth. I remember that. But one thing that I realized, and still to this day, I was always wondered, why in the world you guys had a Mac computer?
Behind the
demo of each 360 game. But it was very controversial because they were like, wait a minute, Microsoft and having a Mac computer there, you know?
The dev kits, the early dev kits, and I'm going to embarrass myself, I think they were G4s. I mean, it's a long time ago, but yeah, 20.
Yes.
22 years, but... But yeah, they were Macs, and they ran hard and hot. I remember that. You know, eventually we moved on to, you know, fully contained dev kit. But yeah, in the early days they were Macs, and I don't think we tried to hide them. Well, we did at first, but just,
I mean, it wasn't open to the public. It was like very hidden, but I think somebody saw it, and that's how it went around.
Yeah, if you look, yeah. The thousands of developers knew that they were, it was running on a Mac, so it's not like a big secret, you know. So, but yeah, those were old, and I want to, I don't know, I'm sure I'm wrong, but I want to say it was a G4 or something from Apple.
Old school. All right, Paris? Yeah.
I mean, really, because again, thank you, Peter, so much for taking some time to talk to us. It's it's clearly an honor getting to talk to you, which kind of brings me to this question, because you've talked about that era and how you look back on it fondly. And It really was the wild, wild west. When I think back about that, getting into content creation back then, and just, you know, everything was completely different to what it is today. But I am curious for you, when you look back at that era and you look back at your career in gaming, what is it that you want to be remembered for as far as your legacy goes?
Yeah, Sega was, so look, you know, what did I know about gaming? I was a shoe guy at Reebok. And so
right.
A recruiter calls me and says, you know, and why did they call me? Because in those days it was teenage boys. That was the core demographic game. The graphical quality, the power of consoles was insufficient to keep you hooked after a certain age. The content that was coming through just was not mature enough. And so it's a phase you went through. But yeah, and I was so fortunate that a recruiter and Bernie Stoller, God rest his soul, said, yeah, you're perfect because you know how to engage from a marketing perspective with teenage boys. And that's who we engage with in video games. And so I look back very fondly at a little bit during that Sega period, which was the Wild West. And as I said, I appeared in the Senate hearings, me, Strauss Zelnick, who was not in video games there. He was still in music. Greg Fishback of Acclaim, which I read is coming back. And it was the John McCain, Joe Lieberman hearings. And it was the period, which most of your listeners will remember, Tipper Gore, who was Al Gore's wife, was attacking, you know, content and American values and trying to put censorship on music. And look, you know, out of those hearings.
Yeah, she ended up in some rap songs for sure.
Well, yeah, I guess, you know, and similar. But we needed to thump our chests and say, you know, we're not going to be censored. You know, we were accused of marketing M-rated games to teenage boys and girls, and we changed. The ESRB ratings came out, you know, and we changed the way that we market. This was very much, in those days, magazine marketing. And so magazines that had a demographic circulation of teens, we weren't allowed to put M-rated games, all that kind of stuff. But was more important that we stood up for ourselves on the Hill in Washington, D.C., and we did. And so that was and I'd only been in the industry a year. That was a moment of pride. That I was there, you know, looking up at these senators and explaining that we were not some, you know, societal ill that was polluting the minds of young boys all around the world. And then I think, you know, during that period, I mean, I had so much fun and did so many wacky things, but we were trying to accelerate what we had started with the Senate into the world of entertainment. That we needed to be taken seriously. And, you know, we were already touting bigger than movies, bigger than music, but the interactivity of games was obviously superior to any other media and still is to any other medium. And then having to justify the fact that if you were a gamer, particularly, you know, playing strategy games or fast Twitch games, you were learning skills that would allow you to take those skill sets learned into the outside world, because people couldn't get their head around games were a waste of time. And we would argue, no, they're not. You're learning strategy. You're making fast decisions as sports games came. And look, the world of, in my later years at EA Sports, we constantly did research to prove that if you picked up a controller and started playing Madden, FIFA, NHL, NBA, Tiger Woods Golf, you were likely to become a fan of that sport. And then a student of that sport, because games became deeper and more strategic and Ultimate Team comes out. So you research the real sport to become better at the virtual sport. But it made you a lifelong fan. And the leagues, to their credit, in particular, I always remember Roger Goodell, commissioner of the NFL, always showed up at our meetings in New York when we came to show him the latest build of Madden, had great questions about, you know, how's this being received? Where are we seeing online start to power this? All of that stuff. So I take, and I could go on for another half hour, but I take pride in those moments, those beats that when you look back at them retrospectively, how we got gaming to where it is today. Because I think young gamers today don't remember, you know, it was underground and despised in certain quarters, and the, you know, the media, the tabloids, anytime there was an unfortunate shooting, they would try to find a video game hook to blame it upon.
And still do.
Yeah. And you know what I also just remember too, so at that time, you know, we used to go to E3 every year, right? And I remember the first time I heard that EA decided to do their own event outside of E3. That was like a big moment in the industry, because now we were like, wait, one of the biggest publishers, they're not attending E3 anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, and that fast forward to today, E3 doesn't exist anymore. And now there's events like Summer Game Fest and this other ones. What do you think about that, not having events like that, in-person events in the States? Because I know we'll still see that in Brazil. They have events still, and also Gamescom in Germany.
Yeah, I mean, the E3 served its purpose, but its time had run. E3 was great for us every year in the summer, getting stuff mm-hmm. on the front pages, doing stuff that we would get not just games journalists like yourselves, but you know, full-on front page journalists, the New York Times, LA Times, San Francisco Chronicle, to cover E3. It became very expensive, and it was trade only all the time. And the world was moving to digital. The world was moving to content creators like yourself. And we no longer, the ESA no longer felt that we needed E3 trade only, media only. And people like Jeff Keighley doing what they were doing, Games Awards, and more content cropping up with the power of the internet, things like podcasts, and allowing people to engage in a very different way. And look, if you were EA or Xbox or Activision, you're writing, you know, $15 million checks to be there. And could you use that money more effectively to talk to the gamer direct? Yeah. You bet. And it was no, you know, E3 used to be about taking orders, you know, from retailers, showing your, you know, GameSpot and Best Buy and Target and Walmart, Toys R Us in the old days, you know, your games, and mm-hmm. getting a feel for how many units they would want. Well, you know, that went away as well. So I loved E3. I attended 16, 17 E3s, but its time had run. I'd seen this before in my previous life in sneakers, in the athletic footwear. We had a huge show in Atlanta called the Super Show. And eventually it became clear that, again, the tens of millions of dollars you were spending, you didn't need to. And, you know, what happens then? I remember Nike pulled out. Within 30 minutes, Adidas pulled out. I was at Reebok. We quickly pulled out. And then the way that you interact with your consumer was changing rapidly. And the internet, of course, and platforms, social media starting to rise. And so that's what happens with trade shows. Particularly in a digital industry like ours, having a physical trade show, expensive and ultimately didn't make any sense.
You're listening to Gamertag Radio.
All right, we're going to continue with our interview with Peter Moore. But first, let's talk about our sponsor, and that's Turtle Beach. Remember the feeling of booting up your favorite game for the first time? The late night sessions, the epic wins, the sound of a lobby filling up with friends. Gaming wasn't just something you did. It was a whole experience, and the right headset made the whole difference. Turtle Beach is bringing that feeling back. With the Gen 3 Stealth 700 headset, is stepping into the golden age of gaming all over again. Only this time, the audio is richer, the surround sound is more immersive, and the battery lasts an insane 80 hours. No more cracking mics, no more missed callouts, just pure uninterrupted gaming, exactly the way you remember, but better. For a limited time only, Gamertag Radio listeners, this is for you. Get 10% of your entire order with promo code GTR at TurtleBeach.com. Don't miss out and stay warm and level up your game with 10% off TurtleBeach.com using promo code GTR. Like right now, we're having a great conversation with Peter Moore about the 20th anniversary of the Xbox 360. I remember those days where me playing games using different headsets, and man, the quality wasn't there. I was even missing out listening like the enemy getting like near when I'm playing multiplayer games like Halo or Call of Duty, etc. And it is important to have a very clear headset because of the sound. Sound is so important to me. So I think this is a great opportunity for you guys to take advantage. But also, we all have that one friend, let's say, that will have a headset that seems to do the typical thing. It will die right away. I'm there talking to them, and then we're down with like a couple players left because everybody got killed. But with the Turtle Beach Stealth 700 headset, it has an insane battery life. You don't need to worry about the battery, and also it has a quick charge that it will quick charge your headset very quick. And also one thing that I love about this too is that Stealth 700 has the industry first crossplay dual wireless transmitter system. And for those that don't know, this means you can seamlessly switch between your consoles, PC, and also with your mobile device with just a click of a button. And it gets even better when you do that, man. So you could also listen to music and conversations while you're playing a game, etc. So really cool. Really excited to have Turtle Beach sponsoring this episode. So for a limited time, GTR listeners, go right now to turtlebeach.com for 10% off and use promo code GTR. That's promo code GTR. Don't miss out and take advantage of this special offer. We want to thank Turtle Beach for sponsoring this episode of Gamer Tag Radio.
This is Gamer Tag Radio.
Final question from me, and before I get to the question, I just have to say this. One thing that I always respected and appreciated about you, I don't know how big of a wrestling fan you are, but when you did the Halo tattoo and then obviously the Grand Theft Auto one after that, you sold the gimmick. You never relented. You never rolled up your sleeve to show it wasn't there or not. I always respected and appreciated that. But you touched on one thing, what you're just talking about. You mentioned social media. And I, again, from your perspective, I'm very curious, how do you think social media has impacted gaming in the industry? Not only how, you know, you being at EA and Xbox before that, how you're presenting a game to the customers, but also how we're talking and engaging with these games, because it seems like with social media, it's a 24/7 cycle now, as far as constantly everything is being talked about, discussed, dissected when it comes to the industry.
It's always been a double-edged sword. Look, in the early days, the very early days, gamers were not given any insight to how the game was going. If you really behaved yourselves, right, we might show you a screenshot, you know, and but it was very much everything is under wraps. Everything needs this big hurrah E3, wherever it happened to be. And, you know, whether it was like for competitive issues, I don't know, but the mentality of the industry then was, do not in any way show anything you're working on. You know, we started to flip that at EA, you know, no pun intended, but gave flip cameras to our developers to do like daily updates. And, you know, I kind of saw this in the movie medium with Peter Jackson when he was doing King Kong. And he did like a daily update called Kong is King, if you go look at it, and where he talked about, and his high-end technical staff talked about the challenges they were facing in doing the movie. And this really, I always remember that, kind of flipped the story around from, we're not going to show you anything because it's got to be secret, big surprise, to, we're going to bring you along for the ride here, and we're going to build community as a result, and you're going to be feeling like this is your game because we're sharing just about everything with you. And so, you know, social media, look, for me, I jumped on Twitter early, even though my great friend David Tinson, the head of marketing now at EA, kind of steered me away from it for a while. But we were going through a tough time with, at EA, you know, worst company in America, all of that silliness that was going on. And so I started to engage with gamers and try to help them out and give them explanations. And so I was on Twitter and very quickly, and I always remember this, Twitter then started to try to get its arms around abuse and racism and homophobia and misogyny and all of the things, you know, that, that when you throw open to the unwashed masses a megaphone, that's what you get. And
yeah,
you could go look it up. I got I wasn't in a conversation, but a gamer in England claimed that FIFA was scripted. And by that, it means there was code in there that if you scored a goal, then the game could score a goal. There was a script and you could never win 10-0 or whatever. There was always a scripting in there. To this day, I don't believe there was. Man, this guy, I hope you die. I hope your kids get cancer. I hope. Oh, this was. If you go look at it, it's you still see the stories today. And so I filed. Twitter had just come out with its new kind of terms and conditions and use it. And they said, no, this doesn't violate T's and C's. You know, it's like gang rape and set fire to your kids in the trench and all of this stuff. And so it was one of these moments in time where you questioned, the value of social media. Look,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
And in today's world, in today's America, I mean, you know, without getting political, but there are mediums that people really are not qualified to, you know, be a part of and give their opinion because it creates divisiveness. It's obviously misinformation. And I think we're in a bit of a mess right now, you know, because of that. People don't have the critical thinking skills to see what other people are saying or what's being served up to them saying, well, that's not right. You just don't have it. So,
right.
But in gaming, yep. I think in gaming, it's been valuable per se, used well. Certain developers and publishers that I watch use it really, really well, you know, but it, man, it could be a rough ride out there.
Oh, it could be very rough. My last question, Peter, I know you've always been looking around, checking out the news, man. What are your thoughts of this new Nintendo Switch 2 coming out in later this year? Very curious about that.
God bless them. I mean, you know, how many times over, I don't know, 30 years, you know, you write them off. GameCube, you think about it and you know, things that landed, things that didn't, but they stuck to their guns. They stuck to their business model. They stuck to their focus on their first parties. They stuck to it. And when the Switch came out, we're all going, wait, this piece and that piece and all of this comes together. And it was a slow burn at first, if you remember. I mean, this thing didn't explode, but it's Nintendo. And, you know, they, for 30, 40 years, have captured the hearts of gamers of different generations coming through. They, you know, have kept true to their roots. Unbelievable multi-billion dollar IP and Mario Brothers, obviously, and you think about Zelda and all of the things that they've done. And you know, once you've got, you've clearly with the Switch, is it 8 years in now? I think, is that what it is? I'm trying to think.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Is it the 8th year?
2017.
Good cycle. Yeah. And then if you could now, and it's still red hot. It's not like the old days of, you know, you're all of a sudden price points are going down. Nobody's buying the new one. There's that little bit of a like 18 month period where game publishers struggle because the new consoles, even if they come out, hadn't hit a good decent install base and you couldn't get $59.99 or whatever it is for your games on the old consoles because people weren't buying at that level. So if Nintendo pulls this off of a seamless transfer of, you know, down on the runway, straight up again and go, I mean, God bless them. Great for the industry.
Yeah. You reminded me of something as you're talking about that.
Because
again, I remember you when I talked about you being on with Tina and Laura back way back when you were basically selling everyone. I was like, oh yeah, you get an Xbox and yeah, go get the Nintendo as a supplement device. Yeah. And it's so funny how now that is completely flipped.
Yep.
Well,
yep.
I mean, look, I said you could, because it's PlayStation 3 had come out at like $599. I said, you could go get yourself an Xbox 360 and and a Nintendo Wii, I think it was. I'd still have like $50 in your pocket. I don't know. Those are the fun things you could do and just, you know, have this kind of console war fun going on with each other. And I think gamers loved it. And I think it was great for the industry.
Yeah. And one more thing that reminded me too, Peter, when I had you, I think we went to Xbox headquarters. I think it was, 06 for Lord of the Rings game. And we did like a round table and you were not convinced with the Wii. I remember you said something about motion control that the media picked it up right away. It was like, wait, he's not convinced? Like, you were not convinced at that time.
Yeah, I remember being at TGS, Tokyo Game Show, when Iwata-san pulled out the Wii from behind the podium, and I was with Robbie Back. I go, what is this? And look, you have no, it's so different, so new. Your first reaction is, well, that's just never going to work. Yeah, well, I've been wrong in a lot of things, and I was certainly wrong there. That thing, and Wii Sports, you think about the things that drove it, and it did a great job for the industry in bringing the family into gaming in a way that was fun. People are still intimidated with a video game controller, but if it's just swinging the controller like you would a tennis racket, as it was, and just you can still remember those screenshots and that imagery of all the families having a great time. Wii Sports was amazing.
Yeah. Well, Peter, I just want to say thank you for taking your time from your busy schedule beyond the show, man. It's been great talking to you, and hopefully we'll see you around in the future at other events. We'll see, you know?
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah. Guys, great seeing you. Thanks for inviting
me. Thank you.
Take care.
Thanks for listening to Gamertag Radio. Be sure to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.